Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Wonder Podcast, the podcast where we break down and review films all in one big, long, unbroken take. I'm Austin Archer, and with me, as always, is my childhood next-door neighbor and lifelong best friend,
Kramer England.
And this one was a big one for us growing up.
Was huge. It was a big one for everybody growing up.
Yeah.
And all the videos I watch and everything that I look at and just like thinking and reminiscing back to it. Like, why were these so big?
Listen, I said this last week when we were talking about maybe doing this.
Yeah.
And I was wondering what the rewatch would be like for me. Yeah. But I always remembered, even as a kid, being like weirdly emotionally caught up in this movie.
Like
the moments where it's supposed to get me, it got me. And yeah, it's still, I just watched it today and I was like, it still kind of works as an adult. And I know that there's the nostalgia factor going on.
Yeah.
But I think weirdly the filmmakers here managed to thread this little needle that's like, I think that the testament of how good this first movie is that we're talking about today is that like it really hasn't worked since. Like no other iteration of this, maybe this most recent animated one that came out, I didn't see it, but it got good reviews.
It was good. Yeah. Yeah. And one of the cartoons I really liked, like there was a newer one that was good, but yeah, honestly, no movie adaptation has worked since. And they've made
live action.
Five. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Live. Even actually, I haven't seen the animated. I didn't see the animated one, TMNT. And then, so I don't know. Anyway, a lot of them have not worked.
And I don't know. I think that like for me as a kid, there was something so rich about the visual world and style of this film. And it's tattooed in my brain. When I watch this movie now as an adult, I remember every single little detail.
Me too.
Every shot, every like just the way that their weapons look and like when they stash them in their belt and like just like I'm watching it now going like, I still think that the production design in this movie is so cool. I think that the world of it is like, as a little kid, the sewer, like the visualization of like these sewer pipes, the circular nature of them.
Yeah.
And they're not, I watched the second one today and they're not circular in the second one. They're square and it's like cheaper. It's like, it looks like they just, it's everything's just like cheaper and less cool. Yeah. And having them be circular and like their little hideout is cool. And the way they get the pizza from the pizza guy through the grate and like all the just, you know, them on the skateboards and these suits, as much as like you can criticize the way that the mouths move or whatever, there's a lot of mobility that the actors in these suits get out of, like they're able to like do a lot. And
The suits play, man. The suits look really, really good. I mean, honestly, you gotta commend them for making Ninja Turtle suits. Like, it looks so much better than the CGI. Like, granted, I have not seen the movies, the 2014 and 2016 or whenever they made them, those Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movies, but looking at the trailers, I'm like, nah, man, those don't look like the turtles that I know. Like the suits just like, they look so good. And yes, I understand that the mouths move kind of funny, but it also like gives it an endearing quality.
Yeah, we were kind of raised on Jim Henson. Like, we were raised on Yoda and like his mouth kind of being like, we're used to, you know, live animatronic characters whose mouths move like animatronic characters. I don't know.
And there's so much more life in them.
Yeah.
Because they are real. Like, I get, like, not to say that CGI characters can't have life, but sometimes they don't. And these ones just like, there is, everything works. The suits work, and it helps you to get connected with those characters so much more than with some of the CGI characters.
Well, I think the difference between the way that they look in these 90s movies versus the CGI look, it's like the difference between ugly Sonic and then when they redesigned it and fixed it.
Yes.
Where it's like sometimes going too realistic with the look.
Yes.
That uncanny valley thing, or like it's a weird texture look where you're like, oh, I don't know, I don't really like how actually lifelike they are. It almost works better when they look more like a live action cartoon.
They
do. when they redesign Sonic to look more like the cartoon from the game, the movie plays better that way. And we just sort of buy into the world of the movie better. And these suits that they used in the 90s, they looked like live action cartoon characters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The teeth are big.
Yeah.
And they're like, it doesn't look like a turtle, but it just, the way it looks, like they have those snouts and they have the big white teeth. And that, I love, I thought the exact same thing. Like, these look like live action cartoons, which makes that it's so much more believable. And you kind of suspend your disbelief. Like, yeah, there's no way that these things would be real, but there's this realism to them. And obviously they are tangible suits and they do a good job. And just like you said with Sonic, like, I can relate so much more to the Sonic that they used rather than ugly Sonic. Like, the ugly Sonic is like, what are you doing? Like, why are you making it look that way? Just like, make it look cartoonish. I'm able to relate to that so much more because they can be so much more expressive.
Here's my question watching this movie, because we talked a little bit about this last week.
Yeah.
You talked about how, like, you know, the guys that came up with this concept, of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, that apparently the origin story is that they were like stoned or something.
Yeah.
And they were just like, what if, you know, and it does sound like that. My question is, was it a cartoon or a comic strip first before it was a movie? Because watching this movie, you can feel that like thing where when April O'Neil first steps outside in her yellow coat, which we only get the yellow coat for a little bit of the film.
Yeah,
but the first time we see her in that yellow coat, it feels like something that jumped off of a comic book page.
Yeah.
And I was like, surely the comic must have existed first, because the characters, the suits that they built just look like live action renderings of the cartoon versions of those characters. I was like, did the movie happen first and then they made like the Saturday morning cartoon, or was it a comic strip first and then?
Yeah, it was. So it was a comic book. It was a comic strip, and a comic was actually pretty dark. Like, it was more, the tone was a little bit more adult, I guess.
Yeah.
It was also like black and white, or it wasn't in color. So they just kind of had like those, and then they made the animation. So in 1987, that's when they made the actual show. And I think it went to 1989. And then they made the movie. So it went comic book, animated series, and then movie. But I think the movie is the one, as far as I'm concerned, the movie is the one that really opened the floodgates.
It lifted the Ninja Turtles brand into like the thing that was iconic for an entire generation, for any boys, especially of our generation. Like, remember the mask that you could buy that had like the little plastic turtle face, and it would have loved that. Like, you know, putting on a little Ninja Turtles mask. So that makes sense to me, actually, that the original black and white comic strip was a little bit more dark or maybe adult.
Yeah.
Themed, and then they made a children's cartoon that was certainly more lighthearted. And that's what I actually think works about this movie, is there's a balance to what's going on in this movie. There's a really nice balance between tones that feel grounded and like believable, and tones that feel really heightened and cartoonish. And they have just enough of each that they work together and they don't feel like they clash.
Yes.
And it's kind of, and again, like I talked, it's a threading the needle thing, because I grew up liking 1 and 2 a lot. And I, even as a kid, knew that 3 wasn't very good.
Yeah.
But I liked 1 and 2 a lot.
Yeah.
But I got curious and I watched Secret of the Ooze right after I watched this. And and Secret of the Ooze is a much worse film. And it's really interesting, because it's a year later. It's like, the next year, Secret of the Ooze came out and this movie was a big hit. And it's weird, because like nobody comes back, like nobody in the principal cast comes back. It's a new director. It's a new screenwriter. And what Secret of the Ooze doesn't get right is that balance. Secret of the Ooze is like 95% cartoonish and silly, and to the point that it's like obnoxious and annoying, and the jokes aren't landing and they're not funny. And then it has a little bit of like pathos for the characters, but it's mostly, I mean, there's the whole sequence in Secret of the Ooze when like they go into the club with Vanilla Ice and Vanilla Ice sings the Go Ninja Go song.
Go Ninja Go, Ninja Go. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just, it's just absurd. And like Super Shredder looks, and Shredder just turns into like a really silly character in Secret of the Ooze. And Shredder in the first movie is actually like, I love the whole way that they do the entire Foot Clan. They feel like a really imposing force in the first movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is the thing about this. This happens a lot. So this movie, what they did, like you were talking about, they very much did a good job of making this balanced. Mm-hmm. They have enough darkness, but they have also enough lightness to make things, you know, a little campy and a little bit lighthearted. Right. But then you get Raphael, who, you know, gets really beaten up really bad. And they were able to find that balance, but they took it seriously.
He says damn a lot.
Yeah, he does.
I remember as a kid, I was like, this movie's cool because like he says damn.
Swears. Like, he's hardcore.
He says it like six times in the movie. He's always like, oh, damn.
Yeah. And it's like such a. But so they took this movie seriously and they did a good job of balancing everything. Now the problem is, after this type of success, a lot of times you'll see this in many franchises, they go way more kid friendly to the point of being like a Saturday morning cartoon. So this one especially, so in Secret of the Ooze, they couldn't use their weapons, so they don't use their weapons at all.
I didn't even think about that. They literally don't.
Yeah, they're on them all the time, but they never use them.
Yeah.
But they could like punch, you know, like, and like, so this movie, they use their weapons. I mean, they don't, you know, use them horribly or
it's
a
not
lot,
like but... Raphael stabbing a guy in the neck with his tie, you know? Yeah.
No, but like and then after that, like, it was like, they couldn't use their weapons, which is really, really dumb. And you see this with Batman. You know, like Batman 89, which came out the year before, was also very dark. They took it very, very seriously. And then progressively, I mean, 2 was a different type of movie. But then, you know, Batman Forever and Batman and Robin just became a way to sell toys rather than trying to make a good movie. And it's like, how do people so many times just completely miss what made a movie so good?
Well, like, what's so weird about this to me is how fast it was, because the movie was a big hit, and you would think that the move for New Line would be like, hey, get the same team back, same director, same screenwriter, same cast, like everything was working for us. Let's see if we can get that winning formula again. And it's so weird to me to watch a movie and be like, this came out a year later and the studios whatever idea they pitched was so bad that everyone in the principal cast was like, no, thanks. Which is like, I'm good. No, thank you. Yeah. And like, that's crazy. And that like, even the director, that everyone was like, no, thanks. You can get a different team. And that they just went ahead with it. Like, that to me is like, usually you'll see something like that after the first one doesn't quite work, but it's like the reason why this spawned a franchise and continues to have movies be made to this day is because this first one was kind of a runaway hit. It was a big cultural
it was the highest grossing independent movie of the time until Blair Witch Project came out.
Wow.
And I mean, they only made it for $13.5 million. And it made over $200 million at the box office worldwide.
I think that's the thing about this movie that I like too, even as an adult, is it does have that feeling of being like a passionate work of like the set pieces aren't huge or massive, but everything that they do have is really well realized and really well, like the cinematography is good and they know how to light the suits to make sure that you're not seeing the seams in the neck and stuff like that. And again, in the second one, it's like, that all goes out the window. It's like, I'm seeing like weird little, they're just taking angles on the suits that I'm like, you guys aren't picking the angles that are making these suits play the best way. I was watching this movie going like, they're really paying attention to lighting and angles on these turtles to make them feel as real as possible.
Yeah.
And, but the whole movie kind of had that feeling of like, everything felt kind of like real and lived in, and they cast actors that felt grounded. Cause even like the second one, this kid, that's the pizza delivery kid.
Yeah. That,
like he's just, I mean, the kid's good at karate, and he was good in surf, you know, he had a little surf ninjas. He had a little career there in the 90s. Yeah. Cause he was really good at doing kicks and stuff, but he is a terrible actor. And you think about like the difference between Danny and him, because Danny actually is like, it's a pretty grounded character, and the performance is pretty grounded and feels kind of serious. And the Danny storyline in this first movie is like, I remember even as a kid being like kind of emotionally caught up in the story between Danny and his dad.
Yeah.
And I felt like Danny's performance, even watching it today, was like, this kid's performance holds up, and it's like, it's solid. But then this kid in the second movie is like, it's so over the top. It's so corny. And that's, I don't know. It's just like the movie loses any sense of balance. And
they did a great job with this. So
I think it's crazy to watch it and just be like, this shouldn't work. It shouldn't work this well. And there's definitely things to criticize about it, but it's like, of course there are. It's insane that this movie works at all.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I really enjoyed watching this again.
And then a lot of fun.
And watching the second one just confirmed to me that like, no, that was actually good, because this is bad. And, you know, and it's not just like nostalgia that makes me think that it, so let's go through it.
Let's go through the movie.
I first of all, I think this movie is paced really well too. I think, and again, like the second one is the same length, and it felt longer because it's just more of a slog, because but whatever. We start by introducing the crime wave in New York City with the Foot Clan and stuff like that. And I've always liked this opening sequence that sort of establishes a mood that feels like something ominous is happening in this city.
Yeah. There's a ton of crime going on, and a lot of petty crime though. They're stealing people's wallets, and they're stealing people's TVs, and they're going through all the, I did think it was pretty funny. You know, one guy steals a wallet, and then he passes it to someone who's walking the other way. And then that guy passes it to somebody who's going the other way. Yeah. And then it ends up with Danny, and he goes and he puts it behind his back. And then some guy's hand comes and takes it. And I'm like, all for a wallet? Like, what?
And they're all coordinated on this.
Yeah. I'm like, wow, you guys really went for it there.
I always like the woman that's on the fire escape watching TV, and she leans into her window, and then a pair of hands come in and grab her TV.
Yeah.
It's just like the physics of it make no sense.
No.
It's just like, but I like I said, I remember every frame, every idiosyncrasy of this film. But April O'Neil is reporting on this, this crime wave, and she's sort of insinuating that it's something similar to something that happened in Japan a while ago. And it looks, you know, and then we see April O'Neil exiting work that night. She's got her iconic yellow rain slicker blazer,
trench coat. Yeah.
And it's awesome. Like, I actually wish that it was in the movie more.
Me too. Yeah.
It's awesome. I will say this, there's this, and it's to set up a thing that happens later in the movie, but a rat walks across the sidewalk and she screams and jumps up on like a box.
Yeah.
But I'm like, if you live in New York City and a rat walks across the sidewalk, it doesn't faze you. Like,
there's another rat.
It's not like a rat being in your house. It's just like a rat on the street. Like, that's where they are. Just like, you know, but whatever, like they need to set this thing up. She comes around the corner to her van, which is also kind of an iconic thing from the cartoon. And the, and I did feel like in some ways watching this movie, it was like watching, like, I felt like this movie was like doing for the Ninja Turtles what Nolan did for Batman, where it's like, we're going to take the van concept, but we're going to make it April's like rundown old beater van, and sort of put the breadcrumb of like, this van could become the Turtlemobile in the future. Yeah. You know, if they soup it up with Kate, and they didn't wind up going this direction with the franchise, but I felt like they were establishing the van as sort of like a nod to that.
I agree.
Yeah. Which I think is fun. She comes around the corner, Sam Rockwell and some other hoods are there.
Yeah. She starts getting mugged, and that, you know, she walks in on them stealing stuff, and she screams.
I always remember this Sam Rockwell going, bad timing.
He was in the movie way more than I realized. Yeah. And it's so funny to see him, but yeah. I love Sam Rockwell, and he does a surprisingly, he takes this role surprisingly seriously.
All of the human actors in the movie play their parts very seriously.
They do.
I think that's also part of what makes the movie work is that the human actors treat it like a real movie, you know?
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
Yeah.
But she starts getting mugged, and then a sigh goes up and hits out the light, and it's all dark, which I guess they had to do because they like ran out of time and they couldn't film like a fight sequence. So they just like took out the lights, and you hear all this, right? And they're like, and they wake up, and all the guys are beat up and they're like tied up.
But I think that actually works better for the first.
It does.
I think it works better to be like as a kid and as a viewer, I'm like, oh man, I want to know. I can't wait till we get to see them, you know?
Yeah. You could still have that while seeing flashes of them, kind of like in Batman Begins when he first, like, you see the camera's really shaky and you see pieces of them. So they could have done it that way, but you know, it does work. The mystery of it really, really works.
I like that the first shot we kind of see of them is them in the manhole looking, you know, through the crack. I will say that I didn't remember the sort of geography of this shot being that the manhole is so close to where the cops are. Like, the shot is like them looking through a manhole, and it really looks like April and the cops are like 2 feet away.
I think they are.
I'm just kind of like, how is no one like, hey, what's that?
What's going on over there?
What are those eyes that are like in the sewer? I was kind of like, why did they not block that to be a little further away? But this is where we get our Raphael's first damn, because his sigh is gone. Yeah.
And they go in the sewer and they're all excited. And then the logo, man, is burned into my brain.
Well, this comes around.
Yes.
I was like, as soon as they're down in the sewer and they're all bossa nova and all that stuff, I was just like, oh yeah, yeah, dude. Yeah.
Radical. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Very, 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 very 90s. I think these guys really set the tone for the 90s.
As a kid, I never really clocked Corey Feldman in the film. I just don't think I was as super familiar with, like, but like watching it today, I was just like, wow, it is. I can't believe I never noticed how Corey Feldman Donatello is. Like,
I always remember that was his voice. I can't. I think just because I like Goonies.
Yeah.
And it was that one. Oh, the kid from Goonies. Anyway. Yeah. He was super big in the 90s. That's for sure. But
I mean, when they say all the names in the credits for the voices, it's like it's all these names. And then it's like, and Corey Feldman as Donatello, like he's the big name.
He is. He got the "and." Yeah, he got the "and." If you get an "and" before your name in the credits, that's a big deal.
Definitely in 1990, he was the biggest name.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I don't even know anybody else who's big in this movie besides Sam Rockwell, who became big.
So the guy who played Raphael is actually an actor that you would recognize.
I do know him. Yeah.
John Pace or whatever.
Yeah. John Pace. I realized that after this was like, oh, it's that guy.
I know. I had no idea.
My head has been that guy.
I had no idea. I looked him up and I was like, what?
he's in the movie. All the actors,
Josh Pice.
He is the only one who worked in the suit and did the voice. So he did the physical acting and the voice acting for Raphael, which again, that voice for Raphael, Josh Pice's voice is the voice that I always think of as Raphael.
Yeah.
Like that's the voice that comes into my head, but he's in the movie and all the physical actors are in the movie, but he was the only one that got to do both, I guess. So.
Yeah. And then like the guy that played Casey Jones, who is great in this movie, he's fantastic in this movie, but he's gone on to have a career. Yeah. Like he shows up in things. And I believe I've seen the actress playing April O'Neil in other things.
She is. Yeah. But nobody's really. Yeah. But anyway, they have their first win and they're all excited except for Raphael, and they go down and we see Splinter and he gives them some words of wisdom, you know, and he's like, I can't even remember what he says.
He is so Yoda in this movie.
Oh,
he's
very, very, very
much like Yoda. All the Star Wars stuff. Like even when he shows up to them as like a Force ghost later on in the
movie. As a Force ghost, even though he's not even dead.
Yeah. But yeah, he tries to get them to like meditate after their victory. He wants them to like, you know, focus. And Raphael's mad and he lets him know, I lost a sign. I lost a sign.
Yeah.
You know, but I can get it back. I can get it back. Yeah. You know, we see kind of like, again, I think this movie is really good at pacing and really good at like establishing characters because really early on, we get a good idea of like, okay, Michelangelo and Donatello are kind of the goof off twins.
Yeah.
Leonardo's kind of the more serious one or who's a leader, but Raph's like the moody, angsty teen.
Yeah.
Basically they order pizza. And I like this Michelangelo ordering pizza. If you put anchovies on this thing, dude.
He is very much. Don't put anchovies on my pizza.
I do like, listen, like it's very much anachronistic to the late 80s, early 90s, all of the teen lingo.
Oh,
everything about their like teenage behavior is very anachronistic, but I think it's fun. Like I think it's very like Bart Simpson.
Very much. Yeah.
Yeah. But Raphael kind of goes out on the town because he's mad and he's brooding.
Yeah. He's going to go to a movie.
Okay with you?
Yeah. He's got a really thick New York accent.
And nobody else does. Everybody else is like, we're together. Turtles. Hey, and he's like, all right, I'm going to go out to the movies then. See you later.
Because he's tough. He's from New York. Yeah.
That all right with you?
Yeah. He really lays it on thick, man.
Yeah. Again, this like the imagery in this movie is tattooed in my head. Like,
oh yeah,
knowing that he goes to see Critters. Like I knew them. Like he's on his way to go see Critters, and that's they do a little funny joke here where he comes out of the movie and he goes, "Man, where do they come up with this stuff?" Yeah. And it's like talking about like you're watching a movie about turtles.
Very meta before meta was a thing. Yeah.
Also, like I love this is like there's. Again, the balancing act that this movie has to do, the suspension of disbelief that you're asked to be like, this Raphael in a trench coat with a hat on is enough for him to walk around New York City at night.
Be a normal person.
And everyone, but like, I don't know, like, you just sort of go with it in this movie. You're just like, yeah, sure, why not?
Yeah. And again, that the balance of it is like, yeah. You know, nobody's paying attention to him. Like I'll suspend my disbelief for that. So,
yeah. And Michelangelo and Donatello get a pizza from a pizza guy. We have a funny little exchange where the pizza guy gives him he's late. So it's $3 off. And
And that they're so excited. But this, I think after the movie, he gets Raphael meets Casey Jones.
Well, yeah, he stops a crime.
Yeah.
And, but I also always think that this is funny in this movie. Like he stops these purse thieves that take a purse from a woman and he stops them. And then when they try to like fight him, he just opens his trench coat and shows him his sign. He goes, but it's also a thing where I'm like, I don't know. Like if I'm in New York City and some like random guy in a trench coat shows me that he's got a single sigh, I'd be like, I don't know, dude. Like I'm not that scared of you. Like I've got a gun.
And you've got to catch up to me in order to do anything with that.
Yeah, or just like I've got a switchblade, dude. You've got a sigh. What is that? I don't even know. You know,
but it's cool.
Yeah, this movie just treats sighs like everyone that sees one is like, oh no, he's got a sigh.
He's got a sigh. Yeah.
It's like later April O'Neil also like pulls out the sigh. And it's like,
yeah,
I just think that sighs are like, it's just kind of like a dorky weapon. But when I was a kid, I thought it was the coolest thing.
It was the coolest weapon.
It was awesome. It was so cool.
It was the best.
Yeah. But it's like, imagine like if a person that like you bumped into on the street pulled out a pair of nunchucks, you'd be like, what?
Like, hey, what are you? Better stop right there. I got some nunchucks.
Nunchucks, dude.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he throws these guys over, like they climb over a fence into Central Park, you know?
Yeah.
And while they're in Central Park, they get confronted by Casey Jones. Again, I think this movie is paced really well. Like the way that it introduces characters, and we're like we're literally like 10 minutes into the movie here, and we're already like everybody, all the principal characters are getting introduced in a really organic way. Yeah. And I like this first introduction between, like, I think Casey Jones is a really cool character in this movie. I think that, and I this first interaction between him and Raphael is really iconic and fun.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You got the cricket. You got to have a crumpet to know how to play cricket. Yeah.
Not like that. They don't. Not from you. These guys need to be taught a lesson. Not like that. They don't. But yeah, it's kind of like that classic. It's like what we were talking about last week with Batman versus Superman, where it's like, it's the conflict of how do you be a hero? Casey Jones is kind of more of like a, I'm going to put you in the hospital kind of guy.
Yeah.
And Raphael's more of like a, I'm going to just make sure I get the stolen property back to the person you stole it from guy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
and I mean, I always remember this too. He hits him with a cricket bat and he flies over and then he flies into the garbage can and Casey Jones runs off and he's like,
one of two times when Casey Jones hits somebody with an item in this movie and they fly through the air.
Yeah. Yeah.
I also like when Casey Jones goes, when Raphael's hat comes off and he looks at him and goes, what are you, some kind of punker?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I hate punkers, especially weird bald ones with green makeup.
Yeah. Which again, like, how would you ever think that that was just makeup? But whatever. Yeah. It goes into the disbelief.
Yeah, yeah. But it's also like, why would you assume that it's a 6-foot sentient turtle?
Yeah, that's very, very true. Why,
you know?
Yeah. Well, are you a turtle? Yeah, that would be even more weird.
Yeah. I kind of like that this movie puts us in a, like, again, the performances from the non-turtle characters are grounded enough and like, and done well enough that we believe these characters and we believe their reaction to what they're seeing and stuff. And the most heightened performance come from the turtles, as they should.
Yeah, yeah.
They're like cartoon characters in a real world. Totally. But then, yeah, we go to basically like, yeah, Raphael loses the fight. Casey Jones runs away. We go to the next day and it's like April O'Neil is, getting ready and her boss shows up to her apartment because he found out she got mugged the night before. And he's got his son Danny with him. And so we realize, oh, April's boss's son is this like this kid, Danny, who's in with the Foot Clan.
Yeah.
I thought this was interesting too. Like Danny putting the headphones on and his dad being like, see, that's what he does. He just puts his head in those things when he doesn't want to listen to me. And I was like, man, it's always been something like this. Like there's always been,
it's the teen thing.
Yeah.
The teens never change, just the technology or just whatever it is to use to stop listening to your parents, you know?
Yeah. To like just add it, you know. But I think maybe before this too, we get a look at like the hideout of the Foot Clan briefly.
Oh yeah.
I'm not sure, but
I'm trying to remember too. I can't remember exactly, but
I'm pretty sure we see the kids going under the fence and at some point, and
yeah, I think after they get beat up, they go in and we kind of see, and we see the henchman guy. I don't even know what his name is, but he's Shredder's like right hand man.
Yeah,
I think that's when we are introduced to him. And
well, and Danny's like working on like an assembly line. Like there's a bunch of kids like unpacking things.
That's right,
and, and that's how, so we know Danny's like working with them, but then. Yeah, Danny steals some money out of April's purse and April, you know, her boss is trying to tell her to like lay low.
Yeah.
She goes and talks to the police chief who, you know, this actor is the only actor that returns in the second one.
Oh, is he really?
No, so I was like, so this guy's the only one that was like, yeah, I'll do it.
The police chief.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I like this sort of like adversarial relationship that he has with Miss O'Neil, get in here. You know, you're telling me how to do my job.
he's yelling. Yeah.
Yeah.
And for some reason, the guy pulling the cables, wrapping the cables, I always, that's the weirdest off scene thing that just like has burned into my brain. Like, I always remember that. And then she comes out and he's like, oh, minute 15, new record. She's so excited.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Totally. And yeah, I was always like, yeah, who is that? I think he works. I guess he's like maybe one of her cameramen or something.
Probably.
And yeah. But she's the thing with the conflict between her and the police chief is that she's trying to get him to look into her theory about the Foot Clan.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want to take it seriously. Yeah. And he kind of wants her to shut up because she's making him look bad on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we see as she's leaving is Danny being arrested. Danny's been arrested. And, you know, then we do have a scene at some point, like a quick little scene where he calls, you know, her boss, and he's like, you got a kid named Danny, basically he's going to tell the boss, like, you tell April O'Neil to shut up she's reporting on it. And basically, like, while she's reporting, we see that the Ninja Turtles, they're like, that's the girl we saved. You know, I always thought it was kind of weird that they have a crush on a human woman.
Well, I guess there's not many female turtles around. So
yeah,
yes, it is weird. It's definitely weird.
Yeah, it's just like, I don't, like, what? Like, so they're attracted to human women?
Why not?
That sucks for you guys. I don't think there's going to be a lot of human women that are going to feel the same way. But
yeah. Okay. I don't know. There's some weirdos out there, I guess. So maybe.
But yeah.
It is weird. They're like, I think that was just more like reflecting what kids would probably think.
Yeah. Know? Yeah, so she's reporting on the Foot Clan, even though the chief of police doesn't want her to, and they're watching it, and also Shredder's watching it. And Shredder basically says, find her, silence her, and sends his boys out to go silence her. And then we see April O'Neil on a subway platform, and she's been followed by Raphael, who's trying to get his Psi back from her.
Yeah.
But yeah, I always like, this guy's voice, and I don't even want to do it because it's, I don't think I can do the accent. But yeah, this guy that's like, we have a message for you, Miss O'Neil. And he opens his hand and then smacks her. But again, you know, like, this is the darkness of this film, because nothing like this would happen in the second or third one.
No.
Where a gang member would like open his hand slowly and then like smack a woman. Like, that's the kind of stuff, like the grit that's in this movie that gives the cartoonish buoyancy of Michelangelo and Donatello, like gives the story some weight and stakes.
It does. Yeah. And I like that April like doesn't take it. She starts fighting. Well, she gets out the Psi.
Yeah.
She's got like, oh no, she's got a Psi, but she doesn't take it. Like, she's a pretty tough person. She's starts hitting people with her purse and everything, and and then this is when Raphael comes out, and
this is kind of the first time we see one of the turtles really in action.
Yeah,
and he definitely, you know, kicks these guys' butts. I don't know how you felt. For the most part, to me, the action in this movie is like pretty cool.
It is like it's pretty amazing. Like, it looks good. Like, it's pretty fast. And I'm just sitting there thinking, how did they know what they were doing with those suits on? Because apparently those suits were like extremely claustrophobic, and like they were extremely heavy, and that, you know, it was hard to see, and it was hard to just like move around in the suits themselves. They actually filmed this at like 22 or 23 frames a second to speed it up just a little bit so that it would look more natural, because they're going a little bit more slow.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting, but I agree, the action, I'm like, okay, wow, you know, it's actually pretty good. I mean, it's not today's standards, but for everything that they had, I'm like, that was really, it's pretty exciting. It's well choreographed too, so it's fun.
I was thinking on rewatch that was going to be one of the aspects that was going to that wasn't going to hold up for me, that the action was going to look more like stilted or clumsy than I remember. Yeah. And honestly, watching it again, I was like, actually, I'm so impressed with what the guys in, like, just like you said, what the actors in these suits were able to do, like the amount of mobility that they actually have in these really constrictive suits. And you're right, I think that the choreography for the most part is pretty inventive and pretty fun.
Yeah.
Some of it is a little cartoony, but that's also like kind of thematic and fun, I think. And there's a good balance between like cool ninja moves and like cartoony ninja moves, but they're all executed pretty well. And, you know, they do a good job with like angles and how they, and sometimes they show stuff in like a really wide angle that like looks pretty good. And Yeah.
You can see them fighting, you know, they jump and they kick and it looks really good.
Like, I think we see them move and maneuver more than we see Christian Bale maneuver in the Batman suit in almost like the entirety of the Dark Knight trilogy, you know, like,
yeah, it's true. Yeah. They move really well. So
yeah,
let's see. And April got knocked out at this point. So Raphael picks her up and takes her into the sewer and takes her back to their lair. And they're like, why'd you bring April here? And he's like, what was I supposed to do?
Yeah. You know, and so, and he gets followed by a member of the Foot Clan.
Yeah.
Which again, like, there's like stakes, like the fact that she gets knocked out and he has to bring her back to save her life. It just feels like heavier than anything else you see in any, you know, it just feels like you get the sense that the Foot Clan are capable of murder, that they
could
kill her, throw her in front of a train if they want, you know, and that Raphael is actually saving her life. And there's something, I don't know, I just think this movie is pulling off a really interesting trick by being able to like balance these tones. But yeah, he gets her back to their place and she wakes up. And this is one of those moments where, like, I think this feels a little forced in the screenplay.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause she's like, once she thinks she's in a dream, which is kind of right. That's a good way to write that. But then when she's like, I'm not dreaming, am I? And she's like, so what, who are you guys? Where do you come from?
Yeah,
and then Splinter's like, I can explain. And then he just tells the story of who they are and their origin story. And it's like, it feels a little, it's a little bit like we're going to shove that in there.
It's just an exposition dump.
Yeah.
And it, I mean, back in that time, not many people knew what their backstory was. So, I mean, it makes sense to put it there, but it also is not, it's pretty clunky in regards to the structure of the movie.
Yeah.
Which most of the structure of this movie is, it flows really well. So that's good, but it is also kind of structured less like a movie and a little bit more like a TV show.
Yeah.
This is probably the worst instance of it. The rest of it flows pretty well. But
no,
this is kind of out of nowhere, and it's just a dump to kind of orient everything and kind of give you the backstory, which does relate to Splinter down, or I mean, sorry, Shredder down the line. But
even the second time that Splinter does this in the movie with Danny, it makes more sense with Danny.
It
like
does.
He's explaining something to Danny because Danny has the symbol on his head, and he's like,
yeah,
I'm going to tell you this story because you're wearing like that.
Yes.
You know,
and that makes sense.
That makes more sense in the story, but versus this one where it's just like, she wakes up in their house and he's like, hello, let me tell you about how we became.
Yeah. And the way he tells it is like, why? What? Like, it's not like she's like, I mean, she's wondering who they are, but like, then he explains it all. So it's clunky, but also like, you know, whatever. Luckily, that's about the only thing.
Yeah, I know. It's impressive that there's not more clunkiness like this in the movie. And the flashback sequences has its own little fun moments. Like, it's fun to see the little baby animatronics of them, like the little baby.
Yeah.
Or I don't know if they did claymation
pizza.
Yeah. Radical. So she now knows who they are, and she takes them up into her house, which is above an antique shop. And they're taking her home. They're basically escorting her home. And I do like this thing where like they drop her off at her place and she's like, I'd invite you up to have something to eat, but I think I just have some frozen pizza. And I love Michelangelo going,
this is the cartooniness of it, which again works really, really well.
Yeah. Like,
pizza.
Yeah. But he pops up like Mario style out of the sewer.
Yeah.
And they do again, like, I think what makes this stuff permissible, what makes it work, what makes it not just like annoying or obnoxious or too over the top, is that the movie has a good balance of tones. It's got enough stuff that's holding it down that we can allow space. In fact, like, I think that the problem with the Michael Bay movies is that they tried to go too serious, is that they tried to make it too grounded. And it's like, well, you need, like, Ninja Turtles needs to have some silliness to it because the concept is inherently silly.
So it
needs to have some self-aware cartoonishness to it. But if it's all cartoon, then it's going to be kind of, it's just going to not really be fun for adults to watch at all. And if it's too serious, then it's like, it's too silly of a concept to take this serious. But anyway, they go up to her apartment and they have pizza and then they're like, all right, bye, April, you know? And and they go back home and the Foot Clan has broken into their house and stolen Splinter.
Stolen Splinter. They go, this was also kind of funny. They go back and they open the door and Leonardo just goes, Splinter. It says it like almost exactly like that. I'm like,
Splinter.
That didn't work.
No.
That definitely doesn't work.
They go back to April's apartment. She's like, what's wrong? Splinter.
Yeah.
But you know what always got me as a kid? And it was a little corny watching it today, but it always got me as a kid. Just, I think it's the way that they film it, is Raphael's freak out when they find out that Splinter's been kidnapped.
Yeah.
And how Raphael walks into the middle of the room. And again, it's lighting. They light him in this way where like his eyes are like really dark and he's got these like really down shadows on his face. Yeah. And then the camera is handheld and it's moving around him in a circle in this like shaky handheld thing. And it just feels it feels really distressing. Yeah. It feels like the character is like having a really emotional like breakdown. Mm-hmm. And even though it's a lot to have him be like, and scream, the way that they shoot it and the way that they light it is like, it's oddly cinematic for a movie this silly, you know?
Yeah. It is lit very cinematically. And I agree. But they go back to April O'Neil's house. They spend the night there. And then when she gets up, her boss is there. And so they've got to like, they've got to hide. And
I always loved this as a kid. I always loved this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They like, she's like, oh, no, you guys got to hide. And then she like looks back and they're all gone.
Yeah.
And it's kind of fun. We see him in different places. Like Danny sees one of them under the table. And when he looks in a mirror, and then when he looks behind him, they're gone. And like you see the Donatello's turtle shell in the shower or something, and then he goes up in the ceiling, I guess.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's kind of like a fun little hide and seek ninja thing.
Yeah, it's just sort of showing that they're really good at disappearing and hiding in the shadows, and but then we go to this scene between her boss and Danny in the car is performed really well, I think, by these actors, where this guy's talking to his son and he's like, what? I don't get it, Danny. Like, I make enough money. Why are you stealing? And he just goes, I don't know. And he's like, you don't know? And it's performed it's done in a way that's like got weight to it.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
they stop at a red light and Danny gets out of the car and runs away. Mm. And I always felt as a kid, like this felt heavy, and it's still like watching it today. I was like, this works. This storyline feels real. It feels believable. And Danny runs away and goes to this is when we get our first like really good look at the Foot Clan hideout for like wayward youths. This is another scene that like this song is just tattooed in my brain. This is what we do. It's my body. It's my body. Like this song is,
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I think I probably speak for both of us and for most of the kids. Like, dude, that hideout was awesome.
It looked
so cool.
Yeah.
I get to go skateboard and I got to play video games and like, wow, like this is so cool.
I'm telling you, the production design in this movie is good.
Oh, yeah.
It's solid. And all of the locations are really cool and really well realized. And that place, where there's like kids skateboarding and, then we get Sam Rockwell, who's introducing some new kids to the clubhouse. Hey, anything you want to do, anything. How about cigarettes? You want regular or menthol,
Those boxes are burned into my brain too. Like he gets the two boxes. As a kid, when I first watched this, I had no idea what those were. And I thought, those boxes are so cool.
I thought so too.
That's how cigarette companies get you guys. Don't believe it.
And again, like this would not be in the second movie or the third movie.
No.
Where there's like a bunch of teenagers smoking cigarettes.
They're smoking. Yeah. They're like, Yeah. So that was like, I just, as a kid, you think it's so cool. I mean, it all pays off in the end because it's not cool, but
yeah,
the area itself, like, yeah, cool. Play. Oh man, I wish an adult told me to go and play. Yeah, that's what my thoughts were.
But yeah, we get kind of a look at, like, in this place too is like a training ground for foot for the Foot Clan, and we see them like training and the Shredder's main guy, he steps in and he fights this kid, and you know, and we kind of see like the relationship there. But then and like we just sort of, again, like the way that they do this in the movie, the way that they show that the Foot Clan is offering these kids, these dissatisfied youths, a place to hang out and a place to feel like they can be themselves, and the predatory nature of it, it gives the movie weight and gravitas. And
it does. Like, yeah. I mean, they're really, and again, it pays off really well in the end because they are just using these kids.
Yeah.
Like they, you know, it really does in the end, it pays off really, really well.
And this is, I always thought that this scene, again, like the cinematography here, I've always been really impressed by this shot where there's a big gong goes off and the arrival of Shredder,
dude,
the way that they light this and shoot this is really cool.
It's a wonder.
Yeah.
It starts as an over the head shot of his shadow moving across the ground. And then the camera comes down and he walks in front of everybody. It comes to the side of him, and his manservant or whatever puts his,
his manservant. Yeah,
he puts his cape over his shoulder blades or whatever.
And I remember that detail of revealing the shoulder.
Like his cape looks so cool.
Everything about the Shredder in this movie is so cool and imposing and scary and intimidating, and it's all completely undone in the second movie. Like immediately the Shredder, the entire second movie is just like, oh, we gotta go get this scientist and make him make me some creatures for revenge. Like it's, he just instantly turns into a completely silly character. But in this movie, this introduction of the character.
Yeah.
And like the optical illusion of like how long his shadow is when he's walking through this doorway, and you can't tell if it's his cape or if it's his, like, and then like his physical form meets the shadow. And like you said, this crane shot comes down and his helmet is so cool.
Oh yeah.
And his like his everything.
Blades on his hands and like everything is, he's very, very imposing. And then the voice that they use is also burned into my brain.
Yeah,
I don't know why his mask, again, like his mask just looks so, and his helmet, everything, it just, it's all very Darth Vader-y, kind of just like really scary. And he's very menacing in this movie.
Yeah. And then he initiates a new kid into the Foot Clan. So we sort of, and again, like it's not played like a cartoon. This is all played very serious. This is all played this kid is being initiated into a dark cult. And he tells the kid, like, I am your new father now. Like, and he tells all the kids, like, we are a family here. And then he mentions something about, and this is, you know, it's like where the movie kind of has a hard time with the tones, but it's also kind of funny because it's so serious.
Yeah.
And then he lets everybody know, we're now dealing with these freaks. And then he goes, these turtles. And once he says, but it's important that he says turtles because that makes Danny go, oh, I just saw some giant turtles over at April's apartment. And Danny steps forward and rats out the turtles. And I think
this unintended
movie does, but this movie does a good job of like those, like the screenplay does a good job of like those implied like information and cutting.
Yeah, it does well, because after this scene, is this when Raphael is on the roof?
Yeah, Raphael and Donatello have a fight. And
They get in a fight over what they should be doing, and
And again, like their fight is kind of serious and stuff, and we have a nice balance because Michelangelo and Donatello just go like fight. Kitchen.
Yeah.
No, pork rind.
Yeah.
But Yeah, they get in a big fight, and Raphael goes out on the roof to sort of blow off some steam, and Casey Jones sees him from across on another roof. You know, it's just sort of just like convenient that Casey Jones happens to be.
Yeah.
But he's like, hey, that's that guy that I fought with in the park.
Yeah.
And again, like the movement of this character as he's like doing all these kicks and barrel rolls and like, you know, on the roof is like they get a lot of mobility out of these suits.
Dude, this I loved this scene as this whole sequence. As a kid, like I would rewatch this sequence over and over again because the fight on the rooftop is really cool. And I mean, Raphael's got like, you know, he beats up like the first six or eight guys.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, oh, how you think you're going to take me out? And then like, there's like 20 more. And he's like, oh, that's a good plan. Whatever he says. And
come on. How do you guys expect to beat me?
Yeah. Yeah.
Good answer. Good answer.
Yeah. And there's a ton of them. And I mean, he really gets beat up. I mean,
but the editing here is so good.
It
like,
is.
Again, like for a movie that's this silly, it just is constantly doing things cinematically. And because it's an indie that didn't have a huge budget, they're doing things. They're just being smart filmmakers about the like April and the boys are down in the basement, so they can't hear what's going on in the roof. And we're constantly cutting between them and this antique shop and Raph upstairs getting beat up.
Yeah.
And the way that they edit the scene is like, you feel the emotional stakes of it, that it feels like Raph is being killed.
Yeah. Well, because he is, he is being beaten within an inch of his life. Right.
Yeah.
And he's like, you can tell he's losing the fight, like really, really bad. And it's, you know, they're kind of like talking, which again, they're kind of happy, which also makes the tone feel more serious because the music isn't really telling you that this is a happy moment, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like this juxtaposition of two things going on at once, which is really great. And, you know, they're like, April's like, should we go find Raph? And they're like, nah, he needs, this is just something he does. Like, he just needs to blow off some steam and he'll be fine. And I think like he'll be coming back here in no time. And then they throw him through the ceiling,
through the skylight.
The skylight.
And again, it's like this is brutal. Like
it is.
Like in this movie, one of the main characters, one of the main characters whose like emotional pathos we've been anchored into,
yes,
it is thrown through the ceiling, and the implication, like immediately, April goes, "Is he like to ask? Is he dead?" And Donatello says, "No, he's alive, barely."
Yeah.
And it's basically like he's basically dead. Like he's in like a coma because they beat him so badly. And then the Foot Clan comes down. And again, the movie does a good job of never like staying in one tone for too long. So we've got the weight of this moment. And then we have a nice little fun sequence here with like Michelangelo doing the nunchucks with the guy.
Yeah.
And that's fun. And we have a really fun action sequence here in April's apartment. And like again, like the staging of this action sequence is really cool. Like the fact that they cut through her floor and then fall through the floor into the antique shop and have,
I love fight scenes that are in houses or apartments or kind of like places where you live. I think about Into the Spider-Verse when there's that thing in Aunt May's house, right? And it's like kind of close quarters. And you've got to kind of like go around different things. There's a lot of different instances of fight scenes in houses, but this is one of those as well. Like you just kind of have fun with the area that you're in. And it also makes it way more personal because this is all April O'Neil stuff. So like, but like you said, they, you know, they're like, oh, I don't think your guys should be jumping down, you know, structurally speaking. And they fall through the ceiling. And then this music change that they have, again, it's like, I don't even remember what it is, but it's so great. That song came on and I immediately was like in my kid mode of like, oh man, this is when like I got really serious and like, oh, I pretend to fight the Foot Clan. And anyway,
well, cause it's also like they start to lose in the antique shop. So they've been kind of doing a good job up in April's apartment. And when they fall, and again, like just from like a weird, like a storytelling point, the progression of the scene where you get to watch your heroes doing a good job, but then you start to watch things slipping out of their hands and you start to watch them all losing and it gets like, you feel the weight of it of like, oh no,
you do
like, you know,
it's kind of crazy. Okay. This, I might be crazy for this. But the thing that kept coming up in my mind, especially during this whole fight sequence, was The Matrix.
Yeah.
Like, I know The Matrix is way better and all that, but like the lighting is kind of similar.
Yeah.
Like to when they're in the are they in the hotel? Like when the deja vu happens and all that.
Yeah, you're right. Like going through the walls and stuff like that.
Like it just kind of is lit similarly. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, it just like also all the Foot Clan showing up reminded me of Matrix Reloaded when all the Mr. Smiths like show up and like they just keep coming and like they're totally outnumbered. So I don't know if the Wachowskis were Ninja Turtle fans, but like I kept getting these vibes of like this feels very reminiscent, or the Matrix kind of feels like
you're totally right, because the movie does a good job, similar with like Raphael's fight on the roof, where it starts them off with like, hey, you versus like 10 guys or 15 guys, and they can do that, but then it just keeps adding more and pretty soon it becomes too much. And they literally crumble under the weight of it down to a lower level. Yeah. They fight a little bit more and they're still doing a pretty good job. But then pretty quickly, it's just like they're getting overwhelmed. And it's like, I remember as a kid just even feeling like, even though it's sort of a silly moment, but like when they grab Donatello's head and start banging it on the piano, it's like, that's a brutal thing. And like smashing cymbals on their heads. Yeah. But then Casey Jones shows up and kind of bails him out.
Well, and everything's lit on fire too. This when the song gets serious, they're escalating everything again. Really, really good storytelling principles, right? Yeah. Especially action storytelling principles. Everything needs to get heightened, just like you just illustrated everything, right? Start small and then it gets worse and worse and worse. And then everything lights on fire. So they're kind of like at their worst point, right? And then Casey Jones comes in and he kind of helps them. And they find this escape, you know, this escape whatever route or something.
I always felt like in the movie, like, how does the Foot Clan not just open that door?
Yeah.
It always just looked like they just kind of like go like, no.
Yeah, oh, darn it.
Close the door. Like, they just, you know, like, it's like, okay, whatever. But Casey Jones shows up and, you know, like I said, the actor who plays Casey Jones does a really good job in this movie. And he's also just like cool. He's just cool. He's a cool character. His hockey mask is cool.
His hockey mask looks great.
It's awesome. It's so cool. I think his weapons are cool. Like, I think his, like, everything about Casey Jones is cool. Mm-hmm. He's sort of like holding off the Foot Clan while the turtles escape. Again, Raphael is comatose. He is out and he's barely clinging to life. And then all of them escape in the van, you know, the turtle mobile van.
Yeah.
And they drive away while April's whole entire building is on fire. And basically her whole life is up in flames. Yeah. And again, like the weight, like the what they're doing in this like kids movie to be like, this is a great kind of midpoint all is lost thing where it's like their dad is kidnapped and they don't know where he is. They don't even know if he's alive or not. Mm-hmm. April's entire building has been burned down. We found out that the antique shop belonged to her dad. So everything that she ever cared about has been burned to the ground. Their brother is in a coma and they're just driving and they just lost a fight like really bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're just fleeing for their lives. And so it's like, when we show up at this farmhouse, it's a nice sort of like respite for the team to be like, okay, you know,
it really is a pretty big tone shift in this scene. But again, it goes into the emotional weight of it because April is drawing everybody. Right. And she's kind of like giving this, like, you know, everybody's handling these things differently, you know? And when she gets to Leonardo and the shot of him just like standing or sitting next to Raphael the whole time, like, again, that picture, and then it fades into each turtle, right? Mm-hmm. And the picture of Leonardo just sitting there, like waiting for Raphael to wake up, like in the bathtub, it's pretty serious, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty crazy. So they like, I mean, eventually he does wake up, which is just kind of, he's like, isn't this place got any food? You know, like,
what's it gotta do to get some food around here?
Yeah.
But also, we found out at the end of that last action sequence too, that April is fired, that her boss called her on the phone and, you know, like
the answering machine that's hanging and on fire,
which I remember that too. So
absolutely.
Much. And again, it's like everything's falling apart for our main characters, you know, they're on the run. They have to hide out at April's house. The van doesn't work anymore. So Casey Jones and Donatello are trying to fix a truck that's in the barn. And I do like this kind of, I think the movie does a good job of like developing this sort of relationship with Casey Jones in April, that we can kind of see there's something going on there. There's like a, she doesn't like him, but you can. I also love this bit of physical comedy with Casey Jones when he's on the swing and the swing falls down.
I was wondering if that was planned or not.
I thought the same thing. I was like, I wonder if they meant to do that or if the actor was surprised by that. Whatever it is, he plays it really well.
He does.
He does a really good job of like making it feel like it was like not planned.
But then this is, I mean, again, this is a good, they all get together and they kind of have like the training montage that they almost get back to center, you know, and then they go, who sees?
Leonardo is meditating.
And
he hears Splinter's voice. And so he goes in and tells the guys like, we got to go out and meditate.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then the Force Ghost Splinter appears to him.
Yes.
But again, this scene is like crazy emotional.
Like,
this, because even before this happened, we had Danny, Danny feels bad because he finds out that like the what happened to April and what happened to the turtles because of him and stuff. And they lost the turtles, we go back to the hideout and we see the Shredder's right hand man like beating everybody up and throwing everybody around. Danny kind of starts realizing like, oh, maybe this isn't the family that I thought it was. And he goes and talks to Splinter. And Splinter tells him about who he is and everything, and then points out to him that he's wearing the symbol of the man that killed his master on his head. But Danny says something about his dad and how he's like, I don't think my dad really cares about me. And Splinter says, all fathers care for their sons.
Yeah.
And it's this thing where you like it like has so much like weight to it because Splinter is again this movie's like dark, like Splinter spends a lot of the movie like tied to a wall by with chains and he looks like he's just like barely clinging to life, and then when he shows up and talks to his sons and he like gives them this really emotional message and they're all crying, it's like this movie is like like
I know
it's
again they're taking it seriously. And I mean, watching it, I was like, it didn't hit as hard as like when I was a kid. When I was a kid, I was like, oh man, like, Donatello or Michelangelo's crying. Like, wow. Yeah. You know? And then this one, I was like, okay, I get it. Like, the nostalgia is there, but that's just the fact that they were willing to go there.
Right. There's nothing, like, there's nothing like this in the second movie or third movie. There's not.
Good job of like trying to bring in that emotion. And like, I mean, it's still there. Like I get the emotion. I'm obviously not like crying. It's not like
this
huge impactful moment for me now, but I'm like, wow, it works. Like
it works.
You do it and you take the risk of taking this thing as seriously as it should be taken. So.
For the story that they're telling in this movie, it's right. It's like, it's the right kind of emotional jolt that they need as a team to feel like it's time to go back. And that's what they do. They show up to, you know, to April and Casey and they're like, we got to go back.
Yep.
It's time to go back and we got to go rescue our dad and we got to go, you know, kind of basically face these guys again that we just lost to. And so, they drive the truck back to the sewer and they go back into their old place and they find Danny hiding out in there. And I guess Danny wants to be a good guy now, you know, because he was also like, Danny got caught by Shredder basically, with he was talking to Splinter and Shredder caught him like throwing his headband on the ground. And so Shredder kind of like cast him out, you know, as well. And so he's sort of like a boy without a home.
Yeah.
And, you know, I like this kind of Casey Jones thing where they're like making fun of him for being claustrophobic, but also, that this is a very 1990 joke because he thinks that claustrophobic means homophobic. They go, you're claustrophobic. And he goes, I never looked at a guy before in my life. And Donatello's like, what? And then April's like, they mean you're afraid of enclosed
small spaces.
Yeah. He's like, oh, I'm not afraid of anything.
Yeah.
And then he's like, I don't need to take this. And he goes up to sleep in the truck.
Yeah.
But again, it's like everything that happens in this screenplay happens for a reason. That happens because Casey needs to be out there so he can see Danny escaping.
Yes.
And going back to the Foot Clan. And so Casey can follow him there.
Yeah. Which why does he go back to the Foot Clan?
I think he goes back to try to help Splinter.
Yeah. I think he does. Yeah.
Because Casey catches him and he's like, they're going to kill Splinter. And then Casey's like, Oh, okay. So yeah. So
that's right. They're there, and then they're getting Splinter off, and then this is when Casey Jones has the confrontation with the henchman guy. Right. Yeah. Isn't that right? Isn't that when this happened?
Yeah. And he kind of gets beat up, but then, and I just remember this so well as a kid, yeah, that like he lands in a pile of stolen, yes, goods and he
sees boxes like, and random big boxes.
Yeah. And I love that. Like the implication here is that like Casey Jones's superpower is if you give him anything that's just like from a sport, like a hockey stick or a cricket bat or a baseball bat or even a golf club. Well, yep. If it's a thing from a sport, Casey Jones can beat the crap out of you with it.
all of them could very well be used to murder people.
Yeah. And so Casey Jones turns around and drives this guy like through a fence. Yeah. And it's just like, I don't think you can hit a human being into the air with a driver. I think they would die,
but they also wouldn't go through the air.
Also, I think the driver would just like break. Like if you hit a person in the face with a driver.
It would bend. Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, I always liked that as a kid. And because I just liked the character Casey Jones.
But then
we have kind of the Shredder freaks out, and he sends all of the Foot Clan into the sewers. And
this is when they're walking out. This is when Splinter is like, "This is not your family." You know, like family does not. And then this is when Sam Rockwell like gives his little speech of like, "This is our family." Like whatever he says.
Casey Jones goes, "This right here, family. That down there is family." Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yep. Great performance. You know? And then Shredder gets really mad and he sends everybody to their hideout. But they were this is like they knew that they were coming, right? So then we have this big fight scene which I love this. That all the Foot Clan are like jumping into the sewers. And like sliding through like street gutters. And
like, as a kid, every time I saw one of those street gutters I thought about the Foot Clan. I thought about like sliding into
I'll just go slide in there, go to the sewers and go find the turtles.
I mean, when you're a kid growing up in the 90s with these movies, every time you see a manhole cover, you're like, the Ninja Turtles are down there.
Dude. Remember we had a manhole right outside our house.
Oh yeah.
And we would drop those little spinners
we would throw fireworks in there, and we would look for the Ninja Turtles. We'd be like,
just like, dude, you could see it. Like you could see down in there, and you could see it was a place you could fit. Anyway, we would always do that. Yeah. Just looked like there was poop down there, but
And I was thinking about that a lot watching this movie. Like when Casey Jones and April O'Neil are walking through the like water in the sewer, I was like, you guys, don't put your feet in that.
don't touch that water with anything.
Yeah. But now we have like the big final third act fight with the Turtles and the Foot Clan. I will say that for how good a lot of the fight scenes are and action sequences are in this movie, this one is a little anticlimactic because I think it's supposed to be the one where they like overcome and they win. Yeah. And it just doesn't quite have as much as you want it.
I agree. It ends poorly.
Yeah.
But I do love the buildup to it because they go up to the building, you know, they beat up all these Foot Clan members, and then the Shredder, like, he just like, I mean, they do him in slow motion, but it's almost like he's gliding down.
Yeah.
You know, and he comes down with his pole and each one of them tries to hit the Shredder, but they can't. They can't land anything. They can't do anything. And I feel like that little section is really, really good.
Yep.
Because they can't, like, they keep trying, like, one of, you know, like, who wants to go next? And, like,
Shredder feels supernatural in this
movie. He does.
He feels more than human.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is it's like really cool that they can't beat him. But then
it always bothered me that they go one at a time. I hate the one at a time thing. I feel like the answer should be like, we're stronger as a team. We need to fight him together.
You know? I think, yes, I agree. I think honestly, you could, if the movie is made today, I think the constraints of the suits is probably one of the reasons why they couldn't do that.
Yeah.
Like trying to choreograph four people in suits fighting one person in a suit. Like if you were doing it today, first of all, if you're making a Ninja Turtles movie today, please make it with suits.
Yeah.
Like, and maybe like supplement with some VFX, but like just make them in suits. But I think if you're doing it today, you could basically like have all four of them going after him at once, and he could still beat them in that way, right? It'd be a very, very cool sequence that you could do.
Heroku Saki.
Yeah. Then Splinter comes up and he's like, he's like, throw your weapons, right? So they have to throw their weapons over the edge.
Because he's got Leonardo pinned to the ground, and he's got his spear. Right. And again, this is a moment where he's like, I'm going to stab your brother in the throat with this spear. Like, this movie is so much darker than the second or third one, even get close to being. Like, and you really feel the weight of it, that it's like, he's going to do it.
Yeah.
And when they throw their weapons away, like, I always, as a kid, was like, oh no, like, don't,
don't throw away your weapons.
Yeah.
And they throw them, and the nunchuck gets caught on the ladder.
Yeah.
And they bring up Splinter, and they have their confrontation, and you find out that Uroku Saki is Shredder, and that's who killed his master when he was a baby.
This is also like this reveal of Shredder taking his mask off and having these scars across his face. Like, it just all like, it works. It's cool. It works.
Yeah. But then this is the part that really kind of sucks, because he goes, and he just runs after Splinter with his spear. And I'm like, why are you doing that?
It's funny that Shredder is like so good at fighting, and then when he fights Splinter, he's just like terrible.
He does the worst thing possible, and Splinter like wraps the nunchuck around the spear and throws him over the edge. Mm-hmm. Which again, I think this is just Splinter was a puppet. He wasn't a person in a suit, so they could only do so much.
But right.
He's holding Shredder over the edge and trying to get him up, and then he just like, doesn't Splinter just like let go of the spear or something?
Well, what happens is Splinter doesn't let him go. It's like the Shredder does something that makes,
that's right, he like, yeah,
he like tries to like stab, and it makes the spear, but then he falls. And I just, again, like the sound of his voice is just it, that
he falls down into a dump truck.
This is crazy. He falls into a dump truck, and then Casey Jones crushes him in the dump truck, and you see his helmet, which presumably is his head, being crushed by this thing. And it's like, that's crazy to put in a kids movie.
Up Casey Jones murders Shredder,
just squashes the guy like a grape.
Of course, and he doesn't, because there's a second one.
He comes back in the second one. And again, the Shredder is immediately just not even an intimidating character at all in the second movie. He's a full-on cartoon character. And Super Shredder at the end, like, I was waiting for the entire movie. Yeah. I was like, oh, I'm excited to see Super Shredder. And then I saw it, and I was like, I can't believe how bad that looks. It's so stupid. He's like wearing a shirt that has like painted on muscles. Yeah. And also, like, the thing about Super Shredder, I just want to talk about Super Shredder here for a second, is he takes the ooze, right? And all of the spikes that are on his costume just become more spikes. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. Those are just, why, those wouldn't change because of the ooze. They're not a part of his body. Like, they're like his suit, just like his helmet just like has more spikes on it, and his shoulder pads have more spikes.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why? Because he drank ooze, would his clothes sprout more spikes? Like, that doesn't.
Hey.
And then his shirt has like painted on abs that are very clearly painted on, and it's like, what? Like, it just looks terrible. And
it was very I remember. I mean, I gotta watch Secret of the Ooze again, because love that movie. But
and then the climax of that movie is terrible, because like, it's like Super Shredder's like, here, and then he basically just collapses a dock on top of himself and just kills himself, and it's like, okay.
That's like, again, like the same with the ending of this movie and Secret of the Ooze. Yeah. I always remember being very disappointed.
Yeah, it just feels like,
and that one
like,
was very, very disappointing.
It feels like the showdown with Shredder, it's built up to be like, oh man, this is gonna be really hard, and then Splinter just kind of kills him in like a really easy way.
Yeah.
And Shredder, it's just all of a sudden becomes dumb and bad at fighting. And it's just, but again, it's like, maybe this is just sort of a budget constraint that it's like,
probably
that. Yeah. I think this is probably the weakest thing in this movie structurally, is that the finale sequence doesn't hit with as much force as you want it to, based on like, they lost bad in the midpoint action sequences, yeah. which is the best action sequence in the movie.
Yeah.
And you want them to kind of come back stronger. And they, I mean, they win, but like you just want, yeah. I think you just, you sort of want something a little more satisfying.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. It really does. They, and then the kind of everything works out after that, you know, they're all, they do the hand, they do the, oh, all four of them do the high five.
Yeah, and we have somewhere in there, God, I love being eternal!
Yeah, exactly.
And they all high five, and, you know, yeah. Casey Jones and April O'Neil kiss, and, and, you know, there's, like, again, like, I think that the actors do that are doing these scenes do good a good job. Like,
they
I think that the chemistry between Casey and April, like, they play it well.
Oh, and well, and then Danny has the meetup with his father,
yeah.
which again gets a payoff, and he's like, I'm, you know, he has that payoff of all fathers care about their sons, right? And so we have that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a good little payoff emotionally in that sense.
And that's the movie. That's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, 1990. I don't even think I said that at the beginning of the episode, but they'll be able to see
that's
it.
That's right. Yeah.
And yeah, and nobody came back for the sequel except for the guy who plays the police chief. And I get why they didn't. The sequel has a terrible script, and it's a much worse. But like, yeah, I mean,
yeah,
I'd say go watch the movie if you haven't watched it in a while, and see if we're being if we have our nostalgia glasses on. But I'm like, this movie works weirdly well.
It does, and I do definitely have nostalgia glasses on, but. You can't deny that it works better than every other movie that they've made. I guess I shouldn't say every other. I need to see the other ones, but
I've got nostalgia glasses for Secret of the Ooze, and it's bad. It's really bad. So that made me it made me feel like okay, all right. I think the first one actually is like kind of impressive. Mm-hmm. So let's get into scores. Okay. What's your technical rating for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 1990?
All right. My technical rating my screen is going crazy. My technical rating is a I'm okay, my technical rating is a 6.5. I'm trying to be more like thinking critically about this.
Okay.
I mean, again, they did really, really well with making suits and like the production design, the cinematography and all that. And I'm being more critical of it. And because like, you know, the structure is a little bit off and some of the lines are, you know, not the best. And it also, there's something, so I'm giving it a lower score of a 6.5. And I don't know if I should be doing that, but that's what I did. What's your technical score?
Listen, I'm giving it an 8 technically.
All right. Nice.
Here's my thing about this movie is I think that the level of difficulty of what they're pulling off is kind of miraculous. Like it just has no business working as well as it does. And I think that's all a testament to the craft, to the technical craft that like the director understood with his director of photography, how to shoot this, how to light this. The fight choreography for the most part is pretty cool. And like, they had to be creative with these suits, and mm-hmm. these suits for the most part work pretty well. The performances are all like weirdly good. And, and then the balance of the tones for the most part in the films, film works. And I feel like the production design is all like top notch. The casting is all really great. The, you know, the atmosphere of the film, it just has some kind of tactile je ne sais quoi that's like really, and I think, gosh, to know it was made for $13 million is so impressive. So I'm just really impressed technically with what this movie manages to accomplish.
Yes. And I agree. I'm trying to take my emotion out of it.
Yeah.
Of like, because all of those things are extremely impressive, which go into my subjective score.
Yeah.
Of the love of it, but just more the technical side of it. But also, they're working with some constraints. So it does need to be a 7. I'll change it to a 7.
And how about the ending?
The ending, I am going to stick with this. I gave it a 6.5 because it is disappointing. That fight scene between Shredder, as we just talked about, wish it could have been better because it's so good with the turtles. And then he just falls over the edge.
You know?
It's kind of like, it just doesn't feel as satisfying as I want it to be.
Yeah. It's not. I mean, him getting squished in the garbage truck is kind of satisfying. And I always felt that as a kid, like that's kind of cool. Yeah. But like, the fight itself and the sort of the action sequence itself just doesn't quite have the like hit that you wanted to have. I'm giving it a 6.52 because it's still just, I think my whole life, as much as I like this movie, I always felt a little unfulfilled at the end there.
Yeah.
And always felt like the Splinter puppet doing the deed didn't really sell for me as much as some of the other stuff does. How about rewatchability?
Rewatchability, I gave a 7. There's a lot, again, even looking back now, thinking about this movie 35 years later, like the fact that you can look at it and appreciate everything that they did to get this movie made. And I think that kind of goes into it. And it's also, there's a lot of fun in it. It's only an hour and a half. I think this is bumped up because of the nostalgia thing. Like I could just, I remember it and I go back to being a kid and thinking about doing all these things. So I like rewatching it. I think it's good.
Yeah, me too. I give it a 7.5 for the rewatch. I always enjoy coming back to this movie. It's really easy and breezy to watch. I also just think that, like, if you're going to watch a Ninja Turtles movie, this is the one to watch. If you're going to watch, if you're going to, for whatever reason, sit down and watch a Ninja Turtles movie, like, this is the one. It's an easy watch, and it's a surprisingly, like, not half bad movie. Like I definitely have the nostalgia factor, but I also think even with the nostalgia factor, there's a lot that just works here on a pure nuts and bolts level that I always manage to enjoy watching it and I'm always like surprised as an adult when I watch it how well it works. I'm always like, man, this movie really holds up. So how do you feel about the cultural significance of this film?
All right. Cultural impact or the cultural significance. I don't think there's any other score that I could give it other than a 10. This movie, I mean, like we were saying, like between us, we probably had every Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle toy that there was. And like, I kind of hit myself because I look at how much they sell for online. And I'm like, man, I had that one. I had that one. Austin had that one. Like it was all, the impact that it had on us, the impact that it still has today. I mean, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, whatever it was, they made another movie. They made Mutant Mayhem, and they've made the movies in 2014 and all those, and there's TV shows, and there's still lunch, you know, still toys being sold, and it's a big moneymaker for Nickelodeon. Like it still has this huge impact today, and it just stays around. So
yeah, I gave it a 9 for pretty much the same reason, where it's just like the cultural impact of this film is huge. 35 years later, it's still the best one that they've ever made. And it still is like the reason for the proliferation of the franchise. Like the amount of money that has been made on this property that would not have been made without this movie and without this movie being as good as it is. It's like, it can't be overstated. So maybe I should give it a 10, but I gave it a 9.
That's fine.
And subjective score.
My subjective score is an 8. I think this is a great movie. It's a lot of fun. I think that all the other emotional stuff that comes with it, the nostalgia, really makes it more fun for me. And then just also the guts that they had to make a movie with suits. Like I don't think that could be overstated, because they were thinking of all these ways that they could do it. They were originally going to have it be like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, where it was going to be like cartoons, like they were going to be cartoons, which I'm wonder what that would be like. But they went for it, and Jim Henson was able to make these amazingly iconic suits that still look better than anything else that they've done. And it's just a fun movie. Like we said, it works surprisingly well in all the different areas.
Yeah. My subjective score is also an 8. There's the nostalgia thing. I just love everything. When I was a kid, I loved everything about this movie. All of the art. I love April's drawings of the turtles. I love the poster of this movie. Like the manhole that's opening and their faces poking out.
Yeah.
Love that. Like, it's just like the color of the VHS, I love the colors of the film. I love the way that their headbands look and bunch around their eyes. Yep. I just like there's so much about this movie that I just really, really enjoy. And even to this day, I love what a weird movie it is. I love that it's such a bizarre, weird, strange, out there concept. And it's so, What's so interesting to me about the film is the way that they make it feel not that weird, that like you, yeah, you just, the fact that you kind of buy in.
Yeah.
And they do such a good job with the human actors and the human storylines. And this is, again, just another thing that's really, really lacking in the other movies, is the human characters are just sort of like nothing. Like, they don't really matter. And they're just, and again, like, you lose Casey Jones in the sequel altogether. You don't even recast him. Like, he's such a great character.
Yeah.
And I just, everything about this first movie is great to me, and there's, you know, every time I watch it, there's still stuff that I like giggle at, that's like not, that doesn't quite, that's a little clunky, or that doesn't quite, but it's like, geez, what more do you want out of a movie like this, you know?
Yeah, really. So, great movie. It's a great movie.
Great movie indeed. Did you watch it with us? What do you think? Do you remember the movie? Did you watch it growing up? Have you ever, was this your first time seeing it? Are you like a Gen Zer?
Oh yeah.
And this is, you know, and you didn't know about what we had cooking in 1990. Let us know in the comments. Like, share, comment, subscribe, tell people about the show, spread the word. You know, help us out. What are we watching next week, Kramer?
We are watching Magnolia.
That's right. Okay, yeah. So a lot of people were, the movie Weapons, which we just did an episode on, a lot of people were sort of comparing Weapons to Magnolia, and we were thinking, what should we do? There's not a lot in theaters right now. Paul Thomas Anderson has a new movie coming out in a couple weeks called One Battle After Another. So we thought, let's go and look at an old Paul Thomas Anderson movie. So we're watching Magnolia because Weapons just happened and One Battle After Another is coming up. So yeah, that'll be a nice, and hey, we've been doing a lot of Tom Cruise, so we might as well look at one of his most iconic roles. So Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia next week. Yes. If you want to watch along with the show, and we'll see and you.
I have not seen it, so this will be fun.
I'm excited to hear your thoughts. And I'm excited to,
very excited. Yeah.
Yeah. It's I'll tell you this without spoiling anything. It gets wacky. This movie. It gets really wild. It gets really wild. Yeah.
Great.
All right. Cool. I'll see you next week then. And we'll see you all next week.
Yeah, we'll see you next week.